Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
In Arizona, we live by a balanced budget. We have made the difficult decisions at the state level, and we don't have the ability to print money. If I had any advice for Congress, it would be to turn around, order sandwiches in, stay the weekend, and figure this out.
We're continuing to build lab capacity throughout the state, so we continue to work with our laboratory partners. One of the partners that we are working with is Sonora Quest. We still continue to see delays, which is frustrating for public health, because we would like to get those turnaround times faster so that we can do the contact investigations.
We are anticipating a normal recession happening maybe a year from now. Now we're going through this more pandemic induced recession. So I still feel like we're going to be the place to go longer term in terms of higher wage jobs, not just general growth jobs. So we're going to be improving in terms of rates of growth and among the top in the nation.
People are going to be so happy to see their old friends, and they've been at home and they've been isolated, and we're going to have some mistakes.
As the Attorney General, you have stood down on discrimination and allowed states to make it harder to vote. But you have used the DOJ as a sword when attempts have been made to make it easier to vote.
And with us to talk about Governor Ducey's latest comments on dealing with the pandemic, an Arizona congressman admitting in ethics violations, and more, are Julie Earfley, communications consultant with Earfley Uncuffed. Julie, good morning.
Good morning.
And Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Emily, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Julie, let's start off with the Representative Schweikert admitting to 11 ethics violations and agreeing to pay a $50,000 fine. In a couple of minutes, I want to ask you both about the electoral impact, if any, on this. But when it comes down to the significance of this, the fact that he has admitted to violations after all this time, how big a deal is that?
I think it's a really big deal, because he spent the last couple years saying that this was nothing more than a clerical error. In the end, there would be no charges, he would be cleared. And now he's essentially admitting guilt to 11 violations, not one or two, but 11. That says to me, you know, if I was a constituent in CD6, that we have a congressman who is ethical. Challenged. So I'm not sure why, to be totally honest. What has really surprised me the most is that I haven't seen a major mea culpa from the congressman. I haven't seen an apology, nothing, you know, where he has said, you know, I messed up, I apologize, this wasn't okay, I've spent the last couple of years focused on this instead of focused on the people's business. I think it's a major deal, and if I was a constituent in CD6, I would definitely be upset.
Emily, should the congressman have come out and say something? Do you expect him to say something along the lines of what Julie said?
I think he's going to have to answer for it when he gets to the general election. And I agree with Julie that it's a really big deal. Coming at it from a Republican perspective, this is a congressman who has, you know, called himself a fiscal budget hawk type guy, a wonky numbers guy. So these clerical errors and you know, what we're seeing coming out of the congressional ethics investigation, which is a big deal in and of itself, is huge for someone who has campaigned and held office under that fiscal hawk persona. It's a really big deal.
Emily, how big of a deal do you expect that that will play in November? We obviously don't know yet. We'll know next week, hopefully, who his Democratic opponent will be. Do you expect that this will be an issue that the Democrat can effectively use against him?
I think so. And I think his opponent is going to be Harrell Tipernany. I think she's done a phenomenal job raising money. If you've ever met her in person, she's very warm and engaging. And I'm not surprised that she's been good at raising money. And I think that's where you are not going away from the story. After August 4th, when we head into the general, he's going to answer for it over and over again, because that would be the smart campaign move. And I would just say probably one of the people who's having almost equally as frustrating a week as Congressman Schweikert is probably Ben Quayle, because I think he lost by, 2 points to Schweikert in that election with that big last-minute campaign spin. I'm sure he's a little frustrated this week as well.
Julie, do you expect that whoever the Democrat is to emerge from that primary to use the ethics admission of guilt against Congressman Schweikert? And do you think if they do, that'll be effective?
I think they definitely will. And I agree with Emily that I also believe it'll be Harald Tipernini. She has an incredible war chest of money to make that point to her constituents. Although I also think that she's, as much as she's going to focus on the ethics investigation and the admittance of guilt, she will also continue to really hone in on the issue of healthcare, because I really do think that that's an issue that's going to resonate, especially in that district and especially now during a pandemic.
Emily, let's ask a couple more questions about David Schweikert before we move on. So looking at the demo of that district, obviously he has safely won, although Anita Malik, his challenger a couple of years ago, did cut it to more of a reasonable margin, more like 10 points as opposed to 25, which is his usual margin of victory. So when it comes down to it, is this a district that truly is, with or without the ethics violations, and maybe as Mark asked about, maybe this makes it even more possible, the DCCC has really targeted that district. Do you think that makes sense from your Republican standpoint? And then, Julie, I want to ask you the same thing.
Yeah, I can see why they've targeted the district. I think he has become a vulnerable candidate, even with his big past wins. And I think they saw a real opportunity there. I think that's why we see Tipernini in that district. And I think that's why we're seeing money flood in. I think it's one that they think they can pick up, and I think they probably can.
And Julie, what about you?
I agree. And I believe that we're going to see that in this primary already as ballots have been turned in. We have seen an uptick in CD6. It does seem like there is a big interest in that district. People are coming out. They're making sure that they're voting in the primary. I think that's a harbinger of what we're going to see in the general as well.
Julie, I want to ask you about the nature of these violations and how easy or difficult it is to get voters to, A, understand what has happened, and B, get them to care about it. It's not a super sexy kind of thing if you can refer to any kind of ethics violation as that. But like, is it more of a challenge because it's a financial situation to explain that to voters in a way that makes them, A, care, and B, understand?
Yeah, I really think it is. And one of the things that I've noticed being in Arizona now for more than 20 years is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest among Arizonans when it comes to, in general, corruption. They tend to look the other way, or maybe it's just not as important on their list of things that they care about, perhaps because they believe that everybody's corrupt and so, you know, whatever. So I think there is a bit of a challenge there for Harald or whoever the Democratic nominee is to make that into a, you know, overarching theme, which is, again, why I believe that while that will be an issue in this election, it cannot be the only issue that the Democrat focuses on. I believe that she will need to, in addition, really focus on healthcare and some of the and unemployment and what's going on in this pandemic, and use the ethics investigations as, listen, this was a way that our congressman was sidetracked. He wasn't really focused on the issues of the day because he had to spend so much time defending himself against ethics investigations. So I think they can play it in that manner versus trying to get into the nitty-gritty of what this means.
Emily, would you agree with that trying to get into the nitty-gritty is maybe not the way to handle this kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of times you see voters not respond to some of these corruption cases because they're so nuanced and so detailed to try to explain, and people just don't have the luxury of following it that closely. And frankly, you know, a politician having a corruption scandal is not a shocking thing to most Americans or Arizonans. But I do think, you know, I hate to lay out a whole playbook, but, you know, I think with this particular scandal, you know, if they kept the message simple, if it was, you know, focusing on babysitting expenses or, you know, illegal, they'd have to keep it very simple. And not get into a lot of nuanced things. I think there's an opportunity there for that, just to get that message across. It's definitely a damaging blow to the Schweikert campaign right now.
Now let's move on to Governor Ducey's what has become a weekly press conference related to sort of an update on the COVID-19 pandemic. I want to give you a little bit of a clip of an exchange he had with a reporter yesterday.
As we transition through this, it will require further cooperation with Congress. I don't have anything else to add right now.
Well, I mean,
we've done our job on this, Dennis. I need Congress to act.
But the $240, I mean, they may not be evicted, but at some point at the end of this, if they're only getting...
We're not at that point. We're not at that
point. I want to follow up.
We're not
on
at that point,
thing.
And I I'd said like I to need to work with Congress.
Julie, let me go to you on that one. So there has been the concern based on whether Congress is going to act to do something different from the CARES Act, an extension to some extent, more trillions of dollars to get to folks who are out of work to extend unemployment. Obviously, we know Arizona is very, very low when it comes to an unemployment compensation situation. Should the governor have been more willing to take leadership on this one? Was he right to sort of punt to Congress? What are your thoughts?
He absolutely should take leadership on this. But I think what we're seeing with the Ducey administration is this is a pattern. And something that critics like myself have been pointing out for several years, when there is a crisis, the governor fails to produce any kind of a plan. And even today, he really doesn't have a plan for how he's going to deal with COVID. If you look at how a number of these things have played out, it's basically, oh, unemployment, we may have the worst in the nation, but it's not our responsibility, it's Congress's responsibility. Oh, we should all wear a mask, but the state isn't going to take the responsibility to mandate it. We're going to lay that on our mayors. Oh, yes, you know, we understand that schools and parents are frustrated and they need guidance, but we're going to wait until the last possible minute. And then we're just going to say, well, in the end, it's really just up to schools. We're not going to mandate anything. It's essentially, I would say this is a governor who wants all of the power, but none of the responsibility that comes with that power. And I believe that Arizonans are starting to see that, and that's why they have so much frustration right now and why the governor's approval ratings are so low.
Emily, we can talk about that generally, but I want to come back specifically to the unemployment compensation situation, because Arizona is one of those states that pays out much lower than many others, and so we're sort of waiting and seeing for Congress. Is there something the governor should be doing? Is this something that should be ripe for a special session? Or is he right to say Congress, the president, is going to eventually, they're eventually going to send a lot of money to Arizona, so please hold on a minute as we wait for that?
You know, I think his best bet is to put the pressure on Congress, and maybe he needs to get loud about that, because he is right, we can't print more money. And with the current makeup of the legislature, I don't know that calling him into a special session to change that weeks before an election, I don't know that you're going to get Republican majorities to vote for that. I don't know that that's a viable option for him. It might be a technically available option, but I don't know that it's viable. So, you know, perhaps what he needs to do is get really loud with our congressional representatives, and that probably is our best hope for Arizonans for some relief.
I think there are probably a lot of Arizonans, though, Emily, who would say if you're hoping for Congress to take action on something as your best hope, that's not necessarily a great position to be in.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's good. You know, there's not a lot that's good right now. But I do think that is, you know, I don't know how realistic it is right before, you know, we're heading into the Republican primary where people are fighting over who's a better conservative. And, you know, certainly, you couldn't call them into a special session today and get them to pass out more money. You know, maybe the COVID thing changes it a little bit, but it's definitely not a sure thing.
Well, so, Emily, in a situation like this, then how does, you know, we talk about a governor or a president or a mayor even having a quote unquote bully pulpit. It seems as though what you're saying is the governor can't really use his bully pulpit to get lawmakers, state lawmakers, to do this kind of thing. How should he be using his bully pulpit to try to get Congress to do something? Obviously, you know, he has 9 representatives and 2 senators. That's not going to get it done by themselves. But how can he be using the platform he has if he really believes Congress is the way to go to actually get it done?
You know, if he believes that's the best course of action, you know, I think he's got to be in front of the media more. And by that, I don't mean Twitter. I mean, in front of the media more, explaining why, explaining specifically what needs to be done, meeting with our congressional delegation, talking about those meetings, perhaps banning with other like-minded governors and putting out a call to action and putting some pressure on and making it a campaign issue. You know, we're in a horrific pandemic with a election layered over it, and it's just made things so complicated and so difficult. You know, we all know that nobody gets anything done during election years because no one campaigns anymore on accomplishments. Everyone campaigns on catastrophes and fear. And so no one's really looking to solve anything right now because they don't want to take that campaign fodder away. And that makes a particularly tough challenge. But, you know, I think he could use his bully pulpit to be a lot more vocal about specifically what he wants to see come out of Congress.
Julie, very quickly before we go to break here, do you think that the governor can effectively lobby Congress if he decides that's the way to go? And it seems as though he has. Can he effectively lobby Congress to get something done quickly here?
I think he definitely could. He has a very close relationship with President Trump. And so if he was suddenly willing to come out and say, this is what's needed, I do believe that people would listen to him. The president's office would listen to him. And he has a close relationship with folks like Andy Big, people who have been hesitant to provide assistance to states, and certainly with Martha McSally. So he really does have that opportunity. And as Emily pointed out, there are other governors who are out there who are saying similar things that he could band with. And he could take, frankly, he could sort of use the playbook that Mayor Kate Gallego has used, and he could go on national news shows as well and talk about it and make his plea there. And that would get the attention, I believe, of both the president and of Congress, and certainly Arizona's congressmen and women.
That is Julie Earfley. Also with us is Emily Ryan with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today, Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed and Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. For a few minutes, let's talk about education, Julie. You wrote a column for the Arizona Mirror earlier this week, and you, a few minutes ago, talked about looking for leadership from the governor. We know a lot of educators are as well, trying to figure out when kids can be back in class or what distance learning really looks like. Is it going to work better than it did in the spring? Give us your general thoughts on what your expectations are from the governor and what's viable, what's reasonable.
Boy, my expectations are just to take some kind of a lead. You know, recently SOS and some doctors, you know, the Save Our Schools. Correct. Yeah, they came together and they talked about, you know, we should really have mandatory benchmarks, not this, well, we'll put out some sort of wishy-washy benchmarks and say it's up to the schools. No, they really need a lot more guidance. And I think if we're being realistic here, if we look at just what the CDC has put forth as what they believe are good benchmarks, it's unlikely that Arizona schools are going to meet those benchmarks anytime soon. In fact, we may not even meet those benchmarks before the end of this year. And I think that that's a reality that we have to contend with, and that we really are kind of sticking our heads in the sand about. And because of that, we have intense frustration, anxiety among school leaders, among teachers, among parents. We really should be talking about, how do we make online schooling work? Because that is a reality that I believe we're going to be stuck with for quite a while, much longer than we've been talking about. So how do we work? How does the state, how do local governments as well, how can they help schools create some of these learning pods, whatever you want to call them, where you have small groups of kids that are together, but they have some kind of, if it's an instructional guide, a tutor, even just a parent who helps keep them safe so that other parents can work, just something so that we can make sure that especially our at-risk students, that they're continuing to learn, that they have access to the technology, that they have access to help. That really is where we need to be focused, is how do we make online learning work for these families and keep our students, our teachers, our staff safe. And right now, I'm not even seeing those discussions happen. And that, to me, has been the most frustrating of all as a parent.
Emily, this has been such a vital part of the pandemic, trying to figure this out. Do you think we are a little bit rudderless on this one?
You know, I think the governor's intention is to make it not universal, but area specific and give lots of options for districts and guidance. But, you know, I get what's coming out of the education and the medical community that benchmarks are different than guidance, and hitting certain benchmarks or milestones, safe is safe. And I can understand not wanting arbitrary dates or loose guidelines to follow. You know, I think it makes sense that classrooms are going to have to be ready to do effective online learning. But I also know that the governor is having to balance a large constituency that thinks that there is, you know, a huge risk to students being out of the classroom and a plethora of other problems that come from that, and working parents who don't know how they're going to teach, and they've got jobs where they're not working from home. And, you know, this has just caused a lot of problems to solve. I'm not sure what the solution is, but I know that he's trying to thread the needle between all of those concerns, and everyone's concerns are very important to them.
Julie, I want to ask you about the time frame here, because the governor has said that the metrics that schools should be using to determine when in-person classes are safe to resume will be coming on August 7th. And about 10 days later, many schools that have not started already will be starting probably with online learning. Is it even possible, given the fluid nature and how quickly in some cases things have been changing here, like how should the governor and the state school superintendent have been looking at telling schools and teachers and families and students when they might be going back to the classroom, when they might be starting school, when they might be starting online learning, that kind of thing? You referenced that, you know, there's been sort of a wait to the last minute kind of thing here, but how should this have been handled, do you think, maybe over the summer?
Well, certainly, I think that there should have been these discussions much earlier and these benchmarks put together much earlier in the summer. To me, this gets back to the article that came out this week with Wendy Smith Reeves, who used to be the director of emergency management for Arizona, and this idea that the governor has really hesitated on creating these long-term plans, right? And so there's been a sort of fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants approach to so much of this, which is why we are seeing guidelines coming out when some schools have already started. So we can't really go backwards. I wish we could. I wish that the governor would have listened to, you know, the emergency management director, and that he would have created these groups of subject matter experts to work on long-term issues such as education. It didn't happen. So now how do we go forward? Well, maybe we start by trying to create this plan, by saying, listen, this is going to be an issue that we're going to be dealing with likely for the entirety of this school year. We cannot simply throw up our hands in the air. We have to try and be creative, think outside the box. Let's bring as many experts as possible, and let's get started on this. I haven't heard that talk from the governor's office yet, and that's what concerns me. And I really do feel like so many of these schools are just being left on their own, even when it comes to something as simple as sports, not being able to just say very clearly, listen, it's not going to be safe for fall football sports. Why not just wait and say for now, we'll start those in January? We can't even make that decision. So unfortunately, I don't have a lot of faith in what's going to happen. But at the same time, I think we need to continue to push for it. We need to push for these long-term plans and bringing people in from outside of the governor's very small bubble.
Emily, from there, let's transition our last few minutes of the segment to Tuesday, which is primary election day, and some races that we're watching. Mentioned earlier, Congressional District 6 with David Schweikert. But I want to ask you about one specific legislative race that a lot of people are watching. And it won't even likely change the makeup of the legislature, as it's considered to be a very Republican district, and that is LD-15, Nancy Bartow, Heather Carter, coming at this from pretty different perspectives as far as the GOP is concerned. What are you watching for? What are you seeing and hearing in that race so far, and how do you expect it to go? Emily, are you with us? Julie, let me ask you about that one. That is one that is between two Republicans, but one is a Republican that has worked with Democrats, the other has not. How significant a race is that?
I think it's pretty significant. That Heather Carter is being challenged. At the end of the day, I really think that she's going to pull out the win here. She is one of the hardest working politicians that I think you're going to find down at the state capitol and as a campaigner as well. So I do think that she wins, but I think it is kind of interesting, especially in this year of what I would call sweeping change, where people are looking for something new, that we would have this primary race between Republicans, because I don't know. That was one that really shocked me, because I thought Heather Carter already has, you know, she has a lock on that district. I think she still does.
Emily, are you with us to comment on that, the Carter versus Barta?
I am with you on a new route. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
You know, everything I'm hearing is that the polling is extremely tight. And I believe Julie was explaining that Bartow is challenging Senator Carter in this race and really sort of propelled into that position by really ultra-right-wing conservative groups that would say Bartow is a real Trump-type Republican, and that, you know, Carter's camp was she's more of a pragmatic, gets things done kind of person. You know, I think both campaigns are getting really ugly and lobbing accusations at each other. Bartow's camp would say that pragmatism leads to her making deals with Democrats. And I think Carter's latest hit on Bartow is talking about how she's an anti-vaxxer in a pandemic. So it's about as ugly as it can be. And all polling indicates that it is a dead heat. So it's really going to come down to who ventures out of the house on a hot Tuesday in a pandemic to vote.
Emily, let me ask you about one other GOP primary in northeastern Arizona, Legislative District 6, Sylvia Allen against Wendy Rogers. Wendy Rogers has run for a few other offices in the past. That district is considered one that Democrats are trying to target. How do you see that primary going?
You know, I worry about Sylvia Allen in that race, and I'll tell you why. You know, I've largely dismissed Wendy Rogers on a number of occasions. Maybe I'll regret doing that. Just because she's run in several districts all over the state over and over again and not had much success. But in this case, in that district, she has been able to dump her congressional campaign war chest into this state legislative race and just blanket that area. Now, Sylvia Allen's got great name recognition and she's beloved in that district. She may pull that off, but it's a real challenge to have that kind of money dumped into a state legislative race.
Based on time, that's going to have to be it for us. Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting, Julie Earfley of Earfley Uncuffed. Thank you both as always, and stay well.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.